Welcome to the CodeCast Podcast. Real-world insights for your daily medical coding and billing processes. And now, here's your host, Terry Fletcher.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 51 of the CodeCast Podcast today. How is everyone? Hope you're having a great day and a good weekend. My Pittsburgh Steelers won this weekend, so I'm happy. So shout out to our loyal listeners today, and thank you for the contact. I've been getting such positive feedback in the form of DMs, so direct messages on my social media accounts. I've been getting some great emails and also some really nice direct messages on LinkedIn as well. So I appreciate for those of you that have contacted me and just said how much you're enjoying the podcast and how much you look forward to it every week. That we definitely try to bring it to you. And it is tough coming up with fresh and new ideas and making sure to keep you interested and you want to continue your downloads. And not only to help you feel like you're getting some education, which you don't have to formally take a class, but hopefully it makes you want to take a class, makes you want to continue in your education process with, you know, live courses, workshops, webinars, whatever. And we hope you look to us for that. And so that's our goal, you know, to really just keep you informed, but to also just bring you a quality product each week. And hopefully you're finding this entertaining as also, you know, informative. And I appreciate those of you that have laughed at my jokes. And I've seen some of the funny emails you've sent me. So that's always nice. We work hard for this product each week. And I say we because without my content and music producer, DeSasson Johnson, and my podcast technical advisor and producer, Joe Kuzma, we are not up and running. So shout out to those guys for making us number one on iTunes under the health and medical category. And we just broke into the top 10 for business. So I'm pretty excited about that. That is really hard to do. So now with over 21,000 listeners, we did it. And we're just really excited to keep it going and, you know, having that momentum. So before we get started, the CodeCast Podcast is brought to you today by AdvancedMD, spotlighting telemedicine as a solution that's proven to boost patient engagement and bring in new revenue streams for your practice. AdvancedMD.com. And Healthcare Executive. Healthcare Executives Network is the fastest growing community for healthcare executives and their trusted partners. HealthcareExecutivesNetwork.org. Okay, so first of all, we're going to get back into compliance. I did say this was a part two series, so this is part two. And compliance is not the most exciting topic, believe me, I'm aware of that. But when you dive into it, if you're a project person like me, I love taking on projects where I can see the beginning, the middle, and the end. I love seeing bringing it to how I can bring it to fruition and just complete it and then how it turns out. And so I look at compliance manuals that way. And really, what do we need to include in them? We started that last week. What is the purpose of a compliance manual? That's the biggest thing that you really want to first start with. Otherwise, you're going to get off track. So start with this, and this is not mandated. This is just some suggestions that I think can help you as you're trying to get this compliance program up and running. So a compliance program really is intended to develop and implement internal controls and procedures that promote adherence to statutes and regulations for federal healthcare programs, private insurance program requirements, but also the program will strengthen efforts to prevent and reduce improper conduct and improve quality care to patients. So you want to make sure that you've got a list of what you want to implement in your compliance plan and how you're going to address it. So here are just some guidelines maybe to consider as you're trying to get this started. So first, the establishment of compliance standards through the development of code of conduct and written policies and procedures. So that's pretty generic, but it just kind of gives you a place to start. Then assignment of a compliance officer to monitor the compliance effort. Now, really what this needs to consist of, especially in a medical practice, it has to consist of a medical provider. So a physician has to be part of it. It'd be helpful if you could bring in one of the mid-level providers if you have one. And then also a coder and a biller. And then an administrator always needs to be part of that conversation. But you want to make sure that you've got the business office end of it, the back office end of it, which is all the ancillary services that you do, and the physician end of it. Now, I know this is going to sound a little bit harsh just coming off the bat, but you really want to make sure that you go by a physician who's passed an audit recently. A couple of practices that we've set up compliance models with, they bring in the physician who failed their audit both times and is not changing the behavior. That would not be a good idea. So you want to make sure that you have a physician that has passed an audit and is pretty compliant in their documentation efforts. And then conduct comprehensive training and education on practice ethics, policies, and procedures. And that's going to be kind of a subtitle for a huge policy section within your compliance manual. One of the things that is really tough, I think, for a lot of staff is the lack of training. When I give you some examples here in a minute about what I've been seeing that'll help you kind of focus how your policy should read, you're going to see that just a little bit of training would have gone a long way to avoid certain circumstances that can expose your practice, not only for an audit, but for a non-compliance kind of meltdown when it comes to reimbursements. So you have to be careful with that. Conduct internal monitoring and auditing, focusing on high-risk billing and coding issues through performance of periodic audits. So you know that in my business, one of the branches that I have is auditing. So I am a practice auditor for several practices that not only listen into the podcast, but are part of my on-demand coding corner clientele. But also I audit for Medicare. I've been auditing for Medicare for 14, 15 years now. So it definitely gives me some insight into what that particular payer is targeting. And so when you talk about audits, not only can you do them internally, as long as you've got the staff that understand what audits need to look like and how to perform them, but also you can hire somebody externally. Whether you use us or anybody else, you want to make sure you use somebody that is versed in your specialty. Do not hire somebody that just says, by the way, I audit. Make sure you get references, information on them, and find out how successful they've been in their auditing processes. Then develop accessible lines of communication, such as staff meetings regarding fraudulent or erroneous conduct issues, a community bulletin board to help keep the practice employees updated regarding compliance activities, and that really needs to be refreshed. And then enforcement of disciplinary standards to ensure employees, including physicians who are employed, they are aware that compliance is treated seriously in your practice and violations will be dealt with consistently and uniformly. Now this last one, and I have more, but I'm going to just stop at this one and then kind of move on to some other things. Appropriate response to detected violations through the investigation of allegations and the disclosure of incidents to appropriate government entities. So that sounds scary. I'm not trying to scare you. But let's just say you find that there was blatant overcoding, whether procedures or E&M services, which are the visit codes, and there was just some issues there where you found something that was not good. There is a provision within the Medicare bylaws that says that you have to self-report. And so I've dealt with a lot of different practices that have dealt with that, and it does get a little bit ugly. So you just want to make sure you've got procedures and policies in place to deal with that. So just have to be a little bit careful. But let's backtrack now and just look at a couple of examples when it comes to why you really need to have this in place when it comes to a compliance model. And if we really focus a little bit on the CBO, so if you heard that acronym, that's the Central Billing Office. So when we look at claim submission, what is appealed, who makes the decision for appeals, dealing with physicians that are non-compliant with their documentation, the issues are identify, reprimand, education, follow up, reprimand again, and continue education. So not only do I have a webinar on how to create a compliance manual with this language, but I not only want to get you started in understanding why you need it, but just give you some examples on some things that maybe you have found that this has happened in your office and you're like, oh, wow, okay, yeah, now I get why I need to do that. But before we get into the examples, this week's episode has also been brought to you by Medical Economics, Smarter Business, Better Patient Care, medicaleconomics.com, for the business of medicine, digital magazine, and health IT. Okay, so this is something that came up that was interesting. I had somebody come to me and say, okay, we're having a ton of problems getting paid for our office visits with our allergy injections. So it was an allergist in Texas. And they said, we've attended webinars, we've taken everything, and we just don't understand why we keep getting denials. They said, we're having a lot of issues with insurance, especially the Blue Cross Blue Shields payers, denying claims when billed with modifier 25. I'm attaching a few examples, and I'd really like your help with this. We are part of your service. So it was interesting because as I pulled this up and I'm looking, and then the accompanied paperwork said, we billed for an allergy injection 95117 with a diagnosis of J301 and an office visit of 99213, 25 modifier with a diagnosis of J3.1, which is the same. And so they basically said, but the claim paid the allergy injection and denied the office visit. We appealed with the notes and the claims, and they still denied it. We just sent in the notes and sent in the claim and said, please reconsider. Can you let us know if this is correct? So I contacted the office before I went further and said, okay, let me just understand your processes here. Did you review the notes first? And they said, well, we sent them in. I said, no, that's not my question. Did you review the notes first to make sure it supported a separate service? You're saying a significantly separate service. That's the 25 modifier. And they said, well, we don't review notes. We just send them in to hope to get paid again. I was like, oh boy. Okay, so that was the first thing. So here's my response. In reviewing the documentation for this date of service, the plan of care after the workup of the patient did not address that an injection was even performed. So the fact that you were paid for an injection was on blind faith by that payer. The record did reflect regular injection schedule for that patient, but it was not, again, clear that the allergy was performed on that specific date of service. Also, in reviewing the encounter for the E&M service, the patient presented and was evaluated for a headache and ear pain, not for a known allergy. So to reflect the true meaning of the 25 modifier, significant separate service, you would need to give a health picture of the patient by using the sign or symptoms of the encounter that led to the injection. So I would have used H92.02 for left ear pain and R51 for the sinus headache for the level of service 99213. This would have shown that the patient had to be evaluated in addition to the injection. But here's the issue there. The notes were just sent without even being reviewed. So now the payer denied it again after sending the notes, but they shouldn't have been sent to start with unless you've got notes that are actually going to make sense. And in the same practice, they had another one billed allergy testing, again, 95004 with J301. And they were saying this encounter basically was a similar situation. But the interesting thing about this is that this one, the encounter was not medically indicated based on why the patient came in, why the chief complaint. The patient basically came in for possible allergies. There was nothing on there that said that they should have had anything. And it said in the past semi-social history, no recent changes in the medical history, patient doing well, no problems. And they said, we're doing a skin test today. But there was nothing in the record that said that they needed it. So when you have that kind of, and I do call it non-compliance, you're going to have a hard time because now this is being sent to the payers inappropriately. And so we have to really clean that up, and that would be part of your compliance manual process. Now, sticking with the billing office, another one was frequency guidelines. So this one actually was interesting, and I think sometimes you just have to have a policy so people can just understand the difference between semantics. So one of the things, many diagnostic tests have what we call frequency guidelines. So if you do echoes, for example, that's a coronary test for coronary artery disease, you can have one every 6 months on an asymptomatic patient, but they still have the chronic condition. There's also something called a device check if you have a pacemaker or a cardioverter defibrillator implanted, and you can have one check in person. It's called an interative adjustment within the first 3 months of implant, and then every 6 months after that, you can have another one, meaning that those are the frequency guidelines that they'll pay for. If you do the check, you'll actually get paid. Well, I had a client ask me recently, they said, hey, I have a weird thing and we don't have compliance or direction on how to do this. So can you just let me know? And I'm like, sure, let's see what we can write up for you. So they said, well, they get into trouble by Medicare because a patient is doing very well with their pacemaker management, but they have not had a reprogramming in a year. They said they had a virtual visit since they are an approved HRSA, healthcare resource shortage area, but that they have not had a device check in 6 months. And so they want to know, can we still follow the patient for their pacemaker since the rules say we needed to check them every 6 months? So I had to actually remind them and say, okay, let's look at this for what it is. Remember, frequency guidelines are just that. They're guidelines, not mandates. So Medicare and HRS, which is the Heart and Rhythm Society, is saying that if you need to see the patient in a certain time frame in the guidelines, then you can receive payment, but it does not state that it's mandatory that you do see the patient. So having somebody that understands guidelines versus mandates is something that should be in your compliance manual. And then what do you do? And this one was really something that came up recently for me, and it actually was a little bit kind of frightening. What do you do after your staff's been trained? Does anybody double check the information, or do they just take it at face value? The reason I ask that is I had a client that recently attended a pretty big session, an association meeting in Boston, and they went to a telehealth session given by a certain carrier. And the person that was presenting basically put a bunch of slides up, and she was sharing them with not only her group, but also another practice that was sitting in on the discussion. And she basically said something about the telemedicine. She said, it's complicated. You have to have cameras, HIPAA, lots of regulations, can't do it from home. Reimbursement didn't look that great. And it's a Q code of $25. And use the modifier GT. And I was like, okay, first of all, somebody's communicating this information to you erroneously. They misunderstood or they're confused. You really have to validate any information a presenter provides if they haven't provided documentation or citations or links to prove it. There are plenty of people out there doing seminars, doing webinars that do not have correct information. So even though it might be a MAC carrier, you have to be careful with how updated they are as well. Just for example, on what she had said, the GT modifier is only used when you're the distant site practitioner for telehealth services under critical access hospital. It's actually been deleted, or I should say discontinued, for all other services. So this information had been communicated by Medicare for nearly a year. So that was very concerning to me. I never want to see anybody presenting information that the masses are going to hear that's erroneous or dated. So that's the one thing I take my pride myself in doing, is making sure that I am current. Another area within your compliance manual that needs to be addressed would be providers that are billing more time than is feasible in a day. As an auditor, you should see some of the things I get. I had one physician that thought he was doing critical care time in excess of 40 hours a day. Okay, 40 hours a day? How many hours are in a day? That's a problem on so many levels, but your compliance action could be focused audits of time-based codes, verifying documentation of time by physicians on a daily basis, and just really making sure that they are accountable for what they're documenting. And one of the other things, and this is, I shouldn't say one of the other, another area of concern is Medicare and Medicaid credit balances, along with commercial providers. So a compliance plan activity on this could be during annual monitoring process, gather credit balances reports for all billing entities, evaluate these balances, and then create a policy on acceptable balance amount and work off turnaround times. So to make sure that, you know, these patients, if they have a credit, are they coming in quickly? Do they want to keep it on their account to apply towards maybe deductibles and copays? But you're not allowed to keep over $100 on anybody's account for any given period of time. And every state is different. So you really need to make sure you're looking that up and understanding that process, or that can really be a problem. We just don't want to keep money that isn't ours. I think last week when I was talking about deductible policy and copays, trying to estimate how much somebody pays and trying to charge them for that, and that's an issue. You don't want to do that at all. Another area that's been a concern for the OIG that needs to be in your compliance manual is Medicare payment for unlisted procedure codes. So evaluating whether unlisted procedure codes are being used for services that should be using either a more applicable CPT or HCPCS code. And then your compliance program activity should be focused audit on the use of unlisted codes. And what have you documented? What have you done to support what you've actually done? So those are just a few things that would be a compliance model. We started it last week, and this would be the part two. I could go into this part 10, but I do not want to bore you with anything that is more of a listening and kind of a conversation piece about a topic. We will have a compliance manual, how to create, how to get it started, webinar this fall. So please take a look at my website at terryfletcher.net, and hopefully you'll find that interesting. It's not an option anymore, people. You have to make sure that you have one in the works, or at least in place, if you're taking any kind of Medicare and Medicaid patients in your practice. And I'm finding that the blues are requiring it as well. So hopefully you've taken this kind of under advisement, and this is something that can really help you. Lastly, I'd like to also thank Keck Medicine of USC, over 500 nationally renowned physicians at a leading academic medical center, keeping you healthy, on track, and doing things you love. KeckMedicine.org, ranked in the top 50 hospitals in the country by U.S. News and World Report, and number one in Southern California in cancer care. Also, Pizza Town USA, they just came on board. So check them out in Shiremanstown, which is Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area. And they are open raining, snowing, any kind of weather, and they're open 7 days a week. So check them out, Pizza Town USA. Also, for those of you that inquired about being a sponsor for our podcast, thank you for your continued support. We now have premium spots available. Just email me directly at terryfletcherccc@gmail.com or terryfletcherccpc@aol.com. And somebody asked me recently, and this was funny, that I actually got two requests for this, so I appreciate that. I'm talking to you every week, and so I think we are starting to get to know each other. You know, my personality, my kind of silly jokes or whatever, if I kind of get a little bit quirky. And so someone asked me to share a personal hobby or some gem or tidbit that may help you get to know me a little bit better each week. Since I am in your head, 30 minutes or so out of your day, every Terry Tuesday, we call it. So this week, I'll share my passion for music of all genres. So I'm a little bit old school. I love 70s music and everything like that. But there's a song that I always want to play when, I just want to be put in a good mood, and it gives off positive vibes, and hopefully you'll check it out. The song is called I'm Good. If you haven't heard it or are looking for that song that you want to sing in your car or play loud for your kids because you want them to think you're cool because it's a hip hop song, but there's no profanity, I promise. And it is a song that my music producer, DeSassin, is the singer. So check it out on iTunes, Spotify, any downloads you think, and he would appreciate that. So it's on an album, Meet My In-Laws, and you can find it on any streaming site. So again, it's called I'm Good. So hopefully everybody is good and you're having a great start to your week. And we'll talk to you next week. So everyone, make it a great day, and thanks for listening.
For more information on medical coding, billing, auditing, and compliance, including how to hire Terry, follow Terry on Twitter at TerryCoder1 or visit her website at www.terryfletcher.net. Podcast producer Joe Kuzma. Music producer DeSassin Music.